In Germany, the economy is booming in stark contrast to other European countries. For Germany, the problem isn't a lack of jobs. Many companies say they can't find enough skilled workers for all the jobs they have. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
At a recent job fair inside a 1920s-era glass and metal exhibition hall on the outskirts of Dresden, the frantic ones weren't the job seekers so much as the companies worried about finding enough workers to fill key posts.
It is fully packed and very busy, but that's a very good problem to have, right?
Hans-Jürgen Neufing is a senior recruiter at Global Foundries, a Silicon Valley-based semiconductor supply firm with European headquarters here in Dresden. Neufing says his company is busy looking to hire some 1,500 people, including engineers and technicians for its Dresden plant, as well as manufacturing centers in Singapore and upstate New York.
We are hiring a very significant number of positions, and we had to adapt our efforts, our recruiting strategies, to this amount of new employees coming on board, right? Especially in Germany, we are seeing a great boom right now. So overall outlook for the economy and the semiconductor business is great.
It's not just global companies that are hiring here. A centerpiece of the German industrial economy are its Mittelstand firms, often mid-size, highly specialized companies that are usually family-owned and run. Trumpf is one such company. They produce industrial cutting and welding machines that help make everything from VW car parts to surgical tables and washing machine drums. Half of Trumpf's 8,000 employees are in Germany. 19-year-old Patrick Wiedemann wears a neatly pressed shirt and dress pants, his hair slicked back with gel. He's finishing a technician apprenticeship with Trumpf. He takes up his full-time job with them next year. Wiedemann is almost gleefully optimistic, despite the fact that most of the rest of Europe is still slowly emerging from the worst recession in a generation. I'm not in the slightest bit worried about the future, he says. I have absolute faith that my company will look after me. Crises happen, he adds, but machines will always need building. Armin Laschet is with the Christian Democratic Union Party in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia. He's chairman of a newly formed national working group of high-level German political and business leaders who are calling for the government to move quickly to adopt a more business-friendly immigration policy.
We need 70,000 engineers, for instance.
Temporary restrictions on immigrant workers from EU member states in Eastern Europe expired on May 1st. But Laschet says that's hardly enough. Non-EU citizens face huge hurdles. Currently, most non-EU citizens have to be earning the equivalent of nearly $90,000 in order to qualify for a work visa. That rule disqualifies all but a small percentage of foreign skilled workers. The working group wants to lower the minimum income barrier and ease other restrictions. But Laschet recognizes that when it comes to immigration in Germany, not all hurdles are with laws and regulations.
Germany has to change. We have still discrimination. We have not the diversity we need. And I think this is what the German people, what the German state has to learn. Diversity is richness, and we need different cultures in our country.
Meantime, labor union officials charge that overall, recent German government efforts to deregulate and liberalize the employment market have led to a kind of Americanization of the job market. Real wages are stagnant. Dirk Herschel is chief economist at Germany's largest service sector trade union, Verdi.
The quality of jobs changed dramatically in the way that we have what we call precarious employment in Germany. So we are talking about temporary jobs, jobs that are not connected to the social security system. 7 million people in Germany are working for less than 8 euros in Germany per hour. We have the second biggest low-wage sector behind the U.S.
Herschel says the government could do a lot more at home to boost job quality and employment. He'll have time to get his point across. The high-level working group on immigration reform isn't due to present its proposal to Parliament until October. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Berlin.
The language of advertising and public relations is meant to seduce you into buying or believing something. Step one in that process is the name. In our ongoing look at the public relations industry, NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that what something is called can make a very big difference.
A really cool name can do wonders for a product's image. Just ask David Plasek. He was on the team that came up with BlackBerry. Procter & Gamble once hired his company Lexicon to help them come up with the name for an improved mop.
So we worked for a little bit with the word of MOP, and then in work sessions with them, we sort of jointly agreed that let's forget about that this is a MOP. This is really something. This is a new idea.
So, starting with the obvious.
Clean, wipe, sweep.
They played around, shaping those words.
Swift with one F, swift with two Fs. Swiffy with, you know, an E, and then there's Swiffer with the ER, and then you debate those things.
And Swiffer won.
Swiffer gives cleaning a whole new meaning.
Today, the Swiffer brand is sold in more than 15 countries and is one of Procter & Gamble's biggest sellers.
And when you take the risk of developing something like Swiffer versus something like, you know, ProMop, it will travel farther and faster.
Plus, Swiffer is easy to pronounce in any language, and that's really important, but not always true. Diane Prang is chief linguist for the company Strategic Name Development. She says, what's up with some of those Greek yogurts on the market?
Oikos, Chobani, Fahi.
Actually, I think it's Faye.
And I know they're supposed to be authentic Greek, but they're very difficult to say.
Prang says the name can have an impact on sales.
If you can't say it, it's hard to ask for it.
And if you can't ask for it, you might not buy it. But even words that are user-friendly can run into trouble. For example, names that start out as trademarks can become so popular they end up losing their individuality. Words like granola, jungle gym, and moxie all started out as brands. Then there's the web address. Every product wants one. But if a name is too generic, chances are it isn't available, as a .com anyway. Milton Muller, a professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies, says the good parts of the internet are all booked up.
There are over 80 million names registered under .com.
But they're trying to fix that problem by adding more addresses.
There's supposed to be maybe 200 new top-level domains. Okay, and so there will be maybe a .music, there will be a .nyc, there will be a .berlin, there will be names in Chinese language script that I can't even pronounce.
In the naming game, the stakes are high. Diane Prang says your name is a shortcut to your brand, and your brand is your promise. But even the naming experts agree, keeping a promise takes a lot more than a good name. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Let's talk about one of the biggest names on the web right now, Facebook. That's one company that's been massively successful in generating positive PR, but now it's in a major PR pickle. Yesterday it emerged that Facebook hired the big PR firm Burson Marsteller to look for material critical of a new Google service called Social Circle, doing a little opposition research. Facebook wished to stay anonymous when it hired the PR company, but bloggers and journalists figured out that Facebook was behind the campaign and immediately outed the company. So now we'll see how Facebook handles damage control. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. President Obama meets with Senate Democrats today to talk about the country's long-term deficits. Mr. Obama follows up tomorrow by meeting Senate Republicans. Those White House gatherings come as the federal government approaches its debt ceiling. So far, at least, financial markets don't seem overly worried. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Top lawmakers from both parties agree sooner or later they'll have to vote to raise the debt limit, but that vote may come at a price. Republican House Speaker John Boehner told the Economic Club of New York this week he's holding out for big cuts in federal spending, cuts measured not in the billions of dollars, but trillions.
Without significant spending cuts and changes in the way we spend the American people's money, there will be no increase in the debt limit.
The only practical way to achieve spending cuts of the size Boehner's talking about would be to go after popular entitlement programs such as Medicare. Boehner says those programs should be on the negotiating table, along with every other part of the federal budget. The only thing he says is non-negotiable is raising taxes.
Well, I've made it pretty clear that raising taxes is off the table. Raising taxes on the very people that we expect to invest in our economy and create jobs will have a devastating impact on our ability to balance the budget.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell made the same point yesterday on Capitol Hill.
The American people pretty clearly believe that We have the deficit problem because we spend too much, not because we tax too little.
Federal spending, as a share of the overall economy, is at its highest level since World War II, while tax revenues are at their lowest level since 1950. White House spokesman Jay Carney told reporters traveling aboard Air Force One yesterday the best way to attack the deficit is from both sides.
The president believes that we need to achieve that $4 trillion in deficit reduction in a balanced way, and not solely by cutting entitlements and eliminating, in the case of the House Republican plan, the Medicare guarantee to our seniors.
What's adding a sense of urgency to these budget talks is the fact that the federal government is about to bump up against its self-imposed limit on borrowing money. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner estimates the government will hit that limit as early as next Monday. By moving money around, he says, he can buy some extra time for lawmakers to raise the ceiling, but not too much time. White House Budget Director Jack Lew has urged Congress to resist the temptation to postpone action until the last possible minute.
It will be a very bad thing if all of the cable TV stations have countdown clocks to government default. The fact of anticipation would in and of itself undermine our position as an economic power. So nobody should be playing chicken with the debt limit. We should get it done. We should get it done soon, early, and get it out of the way.
House Speaker Boehner acknowledged in his speech this week that even debating the debt ceiling increase makes some people in the financial community uneasy. But if Wall Street is nervous, it's not showing it. The relatively low yield on Treasury notes suggests investors are still comfortable owning U.S. debt. Economist Francisco Turralba of Morningstar says financial markets fully expect lawmakers to come around on the debt ceiling after a period of political posturing.
I think everyone understands that it's just a matter of time and a matter of negotiating before we see a raise of the debt ceiling. It is not conceivable that the U.S. would default. I think it's widely understood that it's just a matter of squabbling between the two parties.
Last week, Secretary Geithner told lawmakers that thanks to better-than-expected tax revenues, the real crunch point for the government won't come until early August, some 3 weeks later than he'd predicted last month. That means extra time for the White House and Congress to reach a compromise on budget issues, but it also means the partisan posturing could continue for a couple more months. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. exports hit an all-time high in March, but imports grew even faster, and the nation's trade deficit widened to $48 billion. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that the government has been working to boost exports. It's an effort to grow the economy without having to rely on American consumers, who are already stretched thin.
You can put most of the blame for March's bigger trade deficit on oil. With volumes up and the price of crude topping $100 a barrel, the total bill for imported oil soared by $6 billion. Beyond that headline number, though, there is some encouraging news in today's trade report from the Commerce Department. American exports jumped nearly $8 billion in March. U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk says that's part of a steady trend.
If you look at this over 7-8 month period, clearly exports and our working toward the president's agenda of doubling our exports, which we're well on path to meet, are helping to fuel our economic growth.
There are a couple of explanations for U.S. companies racking up record sales in foreign countries. Economist Gregory Dako is with the forecasting firm IHS Global Insight.
One of the elements is the very weak dollar, which is making U.S. goods cheaper. At the same time, emerging markets growth is very strong, and as a result, demand for U.S. goods is higher.
The surge in sales is widespread, from farms to factories. The Caterpillar company relies on foreign markets for about 70% of its sales. CEO Doug Oberhelman told CNBC today it's a good time to be in his business.
People want things. They want roads, they want bridges, they want electricity, they want all kinds of things that we have here in the most developed country in the world. And suddenly it's starting to happen.
As part of his push to boost exports, President Obama has reopened free trade agreements originally negotiated by the Bush administration with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. The White House says those newly revised agreements are now ready for congressional approval, though trade skeptic Lori Wallach of the group Public Citizen says they could face an uphill battle.
It's extremely mysterious why the Obama administration would put forward Bush's old trade agreements when the polling shows the majority of the public is against more of the same NAFTA-style trade agreements.
Trade Representative Kirk understands those doubts, but insists the new agreements have been improved. The White House is hoping for congressional passage later this year.
We can make a very honest and compelling case that these agreements present that level playing field. They create opportunities for our businesses, large and small. We really can realize some of the job growth that Americans are looking for.
That's no guarantee the trade deficit will shrink. As the U.S. economy recovers, American consumers are likely to keep buying more imports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered.